I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. A recent Democratic win by Lauren Arthur in Missouri's Senate District 17 has many political observers wondering if Dems can pick up another General Assembly seat next door in Platte County's House District 13. Today we'll meet the Democrat and the Republican vying to replace term-limited Republican State Rep Nick Marshall. We'll ask about taxes, transportation, infrastructure, and education to see where they stand on those key issues. Then, far too many people are familiar with the physical horrors of war, but what about the moral injuries that result from it? We'll speak with an Iraq War veteran about the damage combat does to one's consciousness and moral compass. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Democrats and Republicans are squaring off all over Missouri this fall in races for the 163 seats in the State House of Representatives. And yes, that's one of the largest chambers anywhere in the country. Lots of big issues are being debated: a proposed 10-cent gasoline tax, tax cuts, high crime rates in the state's two biggest cities, and the performance of the state's new governor, that's Mike Parson. We thought we'd bring in the candidates for one of these races, and the one we picked is the contest for the 13th District in the Parkville area. The district is now held by Republican Nick Marshall, who can't run again because of term limits. Joining us now, Vic Allred is the Republican. He's a restaurateur and is an Eagle Scout. Vic, nice to have you. Welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me, Steve.
Mitch Weber is the Democrat in the race. He grew up on a farm in Kansas, and he's a broadcast journalist. Mitch, welcome to you, too.
Thanks, Steve.
Now, Vic, you say one of your top issues is lowering taxes. The General Assembly has lowered taxes the past few years. Do they need to be lowered some more?
Well, I think it's not as much as lowering taxes as looking for inefficiencies and finding ways that we can put more money back into the taxpayers' hands. You know, as a businessman, I'm really looking forward to taking, you know, I can look at a balance sheet and income statement about as good as anybody. And I'm looking forward to seeing what kind of inefficiencies there are and whether there can be any consolidation of services so that we can still provide the services that we need: education, transportation, infrastructure, the stuff that we really do need to pay attention to.
You know, lots of lawmakers talk about inefficiencies in Jeff City, and we hear that every 2 years. You think by now all the inefficiency would have been wrung out of the state capitol.
Well, unfortunately, that really doesn't work that way. When you get down there and they talk about getting rid of government jobs and different things, that, you know, and once you get down there and you get into that culture, I think that's one really unique thing, at least about the 13th district and also our senatorial district. All four of us that are running, both for the Senate and then in 13th, are not politicians. And so I think no matter who wins on both sides of those races, I think we're going to be able to bring a fresh outlook. And this is also going to be the largest incoming class for the Missouri House of Representatives in a long, long time. And so, you know, if there's more people that are more open-minded, then we can actually find ways where we can properly consolidate some services.
Mitch Weber, are you do you want to cut taxes?
Not right now, not at this rate. We were kind of talking about the new voices that are coming into the state legislature. So we have had a legislature the Republicans have a supermajority in the legislature right now. So everything that's happened the last 10, 15 years, that has been on the supermajority. And that's why we need new voices to get in there and really and get a chance to work with both sides. And no matter how many Democrats are elected come November, there'll still be a majority. But if we can get some new voices in there to kind of get in there and talk about the important issues that come from our district, then we'll be able to make change.
Now, your opponent talked about all the inefficiency in state government. Do you believe there's a lot of inefficiency out there?
I guess it depends on the issues and the inefficiencies. I think, you know, depending on government spending. I mean, if you look at the state with not expanding Medicaid, when that money could have gone back to, you know, we could have been one of the 17, I think, states that still need to expand Medicaid.
And the money, you would expand it, I take it.
I would absolutely expand Medicaid, bringing, I think it's 1.8 $1 billion into the state, and that's money that state taxpayers don't have to pay.
Mm-hmm. Would you expand Medicaid, Vic?
Not at this time. Not with the way Obamacare is imploding. You know, unfortunately, the time to expand Medicaid was 5 years ago, or you know, whenever it first came out, because then the cost to the state was only 10%. The federal government was picking up over 90% of that cost. The legislature at that time determined that they didn't even want to pay that extra 10%. They couldn't find that 10%. And 10% of the Medicaid budget is quite a lot of money. And then they were worried that what would happen if the 90% then slowly deteriorated to where now we're 100% of all these new Medicaid folks. So at this point, I won't, because until we figure out a better solution on health care, because Obamacare is not working, and we really need to find a way to get more people insured. But
so you're going to say no to $1.8 billion?
Yes, because again, that $1.8 billion, while it comes with that caveat that will help pay for it, the additional burden to the state, we don't have that budget for.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering why the two of you have decided to run for a state representative seat in Jefferson City. What was it that drew you to Missouri government, Missouri politics, Mitch, that makes you want to sort of put part of your life on hold and go down to Jeff City?
So I was a TV reporter for a number of years. I spent years listening to hardworking Missourians about the issues that are important to them. And when this seat became available, and it's not like politics was nothing. I mean, I'd thought of politics kind of been in the back of my mind for a number of years. Covering right. politics, when you're in it, you were working with campaigns, but you're also hearing from the hardworking Missourians when you're covering stories about education, about healthcare.
Right.
And I am now in a situation where I'm a small business owner and in Parkville, and listening to people over the last couple of years, and you know, they've said my lawmakers are not listening to me. They're not paying attention to me. And so that's why I decided to run, because I thought, you know, I'm in a point right now where I have an understanding of listening to people. I've listened to people for 16 years covering stories, and that's really what people want. When we're knocking on doors, we hear this, you know, this is the first time someone has actually knocked on my door in our district.
Right.
And I just want someone to listen to me. I want to make sure that when they're reaching out to their state official, that they are taking their voices into account when they are making law.
Vic, why do you want to run for District 13 state rep in the state of Missouri?
You know, that's a great question, because I really had never intended to run until about 8 months ago. And, you know, as a restaurateur, advocacy has always been a big part of my life. I've always been active in the restaurant associations, whether that was in our original locations in Texas or whether that's here in Kansas City. And we're involved in Columbia, we're involved in Omaha, and all the locations that I have. And I'm the past chair of the Missouri Restaurant Association, as well as I serve on the board for the National Restaurant Association right now, currently. And I represent the great state of Missouri there on the National Restaurant Association board. So I've done a lot of advocacy at every level, both at the state level, at the city level, and also at the national level. And I have great relationships with all of our national representatives, mm-hmm. and great relationships with many of the representatives that are now down in Jeff City. Also, just because of advocacy and the different issues that I've decided to put my efforts behind, I do know a lot of the lobbying groups and a lot of the folks in Jeff City. And so when this seat became open, I hadn't given it any thought, and then I was actually recruited by the HRCC, and they identified me in the 13th. And at that time, with them willing to basically not necessarily give me the primary, but throw their weight behind me, I had hoped that I wouldn't have a primary challenge, and as it was, I didn't. And so looking forward to the general election. But I think the biggest reason that I said yes, Steve, and it's a very bipartisan issue, and it relates to how we get along with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's been such a toxic atmosphere down there, and unfortunately,
I was really struck by the fact that two of you were just chit-chatting like your old buddies before we went on the air today. I gather the relationship between the two of you is pretty solid.
It is definitely not adversarial.
Yeah.
No, Mitch and I are neighbors. Thing. We both live in the same neighborhood, and just northwest of our Parkville, the National Golf Course, and he lives on the south side. I live on the north side, and But I do think that some of the discussions between some of the legislators and the governors, and then between legislatures, and there were talkings about lynchings and assassinations and all the stuff, and that just it's just not the way it should be. And it's particularly in the Senate. And the Senate is a place for gentlemen and gentle ladies, and they need to be able to be respectful of each other. And I've always been very respectful of the people that are on the other side of any issue. And it's also very, very important to get to talk to them and work with them and hear their opinions.
Yeah. You know, another one of the big issues that's out there this year is this dime increase to the cost of gasoline to help the state highway program. Vic, transportation you list as one of your big issues. Mitch, I'm wondering, does this increase in the gas tax make sense to you?
It absolutely does. And, you know, a lot of times infrastructure, transportation, that's another thing that we are hearing. I'm especially hearing when I'm knocking on the doors. What exactly,
people are worried about it.
Yeah, what exactly does that mean? And also, it's also been brought to my attention about, what about, so let's say we're going to increase the gas tax, but now we're seeing that more and more people are buying electric cars. What will happen then? Mm-hmm. And from what I understand from talking with current lawmakers, that has also kind of been put into this legislation, that mm-hmm. if it's passed, that will also cover it. So I'm definitely for a transportation tax, and I know that part of the funding will also be going to the Missouri Highway Patrol.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that's also incredibly important.
Vic, you're a backer of an improved transportation system. Are you backing this tax?
Absolutely. You know, this is one where the legislators kind of just gave up on it. They said to themselves, even though many of them taken the Grover Norquist no tax pledge, that's why they put this on the ballot, because they didn't want to actually vote for a tax increase. But at this time, we really need it. Missouri is the lowest gas tax in the nation, and it hasn't changed since the 90s. And mm-hmm. But as Mitch mentioned, driving habits are changing. And also, vehicles are more car efficient, and then you have electric vehicles don't even use gas.
Mm-hmm.
So nationally, we're looking, particularly Sam Graves is looking at some kind of usage fee. It could be easily tied to, you know, when you register your car, and maybe you just list an odometer. You have to have an odometer reading anyway when you get your inspection on your vehicle. So, you know, you could turn around and say, okay, well, maybe there's a formula or something related to that, and we add a little bit on every time you re-register your vehicle. Because that you have to come up with something, because those folks that use electric vehicles are going to have to be able to pay for some of the transportation.
Mitch, what about the Clean Missouri Initiative aimed at improving ethics at the State House? That would change the redistricting process that occurs once a decade. Are you on board with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that voters are kind of tired of some of the money that goes into campaigns. People are just surprised at the amount that someone can contribute. And I think Clean Missouri will go to limiting that. I mean, right now we can only get $2,600
mm-hmm.
For a donation. That would go down to, I think, $2,000. So I think that's important. And also, we haven't experienced that, but a lot of current state lawmakers experience lobbyists.
Right.
Lobbyists giving them money for sporting events, for all kinds of things. And that would limit it to, I think, $5 a day.
And you're all for that.
Absolutely.
How about you, Vic?
Well, I'm all for the spirit of what's going into Clean Missouri, but I'm totally against Clean Missouri as the way it's written. You know, Proposition B already lowered the limits from all these unlimited contributions that we had before. You know, you used to be able to just find one guy and he could write you a check for $50,000. You know, Mitch and I got a hustle for $100 contributions and this and that, and at $2,600 as a max contribution. To me, $2,600 or $2,000, I don't think that's a game changer. The gifts is not a really issue to me. I don't really accept lobbying gifts. I'm not going to accept them if I'm elected. So for me, that's really a not issue. I think for some people it is, but I don't think, to be honest, somebody taking me to a Royals game is going to influence my decision on a $1 million or multi-billion-dollar contract.
So you're voting no on this thing.
Yeah, I'm definitely voting no. But the biggest reason is not really the ethical reason. Is because of the change in the way they would redistrict. You know, they use the term, I guess it's competitive and lawful, or and And to do that, you would have we've taken a bipartisan guy in California and sent him basically the wording for this for this Clean Missouri Act and asked him to be act as a demographer. And what happened was is the only way that he could make districts competitive by having enough independents and have enough Republicans and enough Democrats in them to make them all competitive. You would have regions that start in the east side of St. Louis and come all the way over and are just a skinny little rail like a pencil to pick up Columbia. You'd have Kansas City regions going all the way down and picking up portions of Joplin. As a candidate,
You have issues with that.
Oh, terribly, terrible issues. First of all, they need to be more demographically insured. And the way they are right now, the way they have this written, the state auditor would be the one that would appoint three people for the legislature to preview. Now, there's nothing in our state government that would ever give the auditor that kind of authority. And the only reason they're doing it now, because the auditor is the only Democratic, the only state office that's held by a Democrat. So they're trying to get that person partisan.
You're voting against.
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Let's turn to violent crime in Kansas City. The city, you know, routinely ranks as among the nation's most violent cities, most deadly cities. What can be done about it, Mitch? As you look at the range of options, what can the state do to help out Kansas City, Missouri, when it comes to violent crime?
Well, I was actually just having a conversation about this about a week ago with a friend of mine who is in the Kansas City School District. He's an administrator, and he was talking about the challenges that they face on a daily basis at a certain high school. I don't want to tell you exactly which one, because of a conversation we had that he didn't want me to obviously. Identify him.
Yeah.
But he was saying, you know, every day he goes to school and he just prays that today is not the day there is a school shooting. He said the violence within the schools, he believes, and I agree with him, transfers over to outside of school.
So what should be done about it?
Well, I think it kind of goes back to the importance of education. The importance of making sure that education is level for all different backgrounds. And he was saying that, you know, a lot of these kids, they believe that they're stuck. Mm-hmm. They are stuck in a low income family, and they don't see that that's going to change.
Could you see changing gun laws in this state so that the city proper, there are regulations on who can carry and possess a gun that might be different than what's in outstate Missouri?
Absolutely, and I think that also goes along to the things that we can do that would affect all Missourians, including stronger background checks, making sure that is something that we can look into. The majority of people, you see survey after survey, you know, I stand behind the Second Amendment, but also the fact that we still need stronger background checks. I've talked to law enforcement officers. They're kind of the same thing. The thing that they are running into with people who have had a history of domestic violence, yet they can still possess a firearm,
right?
And the dangerous situation that sets up for law enforcement and also the people who have to live with them.
Vic, again, you're the Republican in this race. Vic Allred, I'm wondering what you can do to help stem the violence levels in Kansas City, Missouri.
Well, you know, I think it's a really great question, and I have two brothers that are police officers, and so we worry about them every day. They go to work, and I'm a big fan of law enforcement and first responders and the jobs that they do. I think Mitch hit the nail right on the head, though, and it's not a short-term solution, but it's definitely the long-term solution, and that is education. I supported the mayor's action to start working on pre-K, and even though that was killed, I think that's something that we need to work on.
What about in the short term? What can the state legislature do to make citizens who live, especially on the east side, feel more comfortable where they live?
Well, I think in the short term, I think common sense. There's some common sense gun reform that could take place, particularly related to how a person obtains a gun. You know, whether that be a waiting period. I know people, particularly in my party, would be unhappy with this answer, but. But, you know, maybe there needs to be a waiting period because a person maybe has displays of mental illness. You know, you just go in and you lie on that report, you can still get something. So, I'm a little bit worried about that. I think bump stocks should be eliminated. You know, the guy that shot up all those folks in Vegas, you know, perhaps,
right.
You know, maybe wouldn't have killed as many, you know, the High Magazine, you know, things. Guys that are going hunting with, you know, an AR-15 and a high-capacity magazine, I don't know about that. So, you know, I think there's some common sense things could be done, you know. And then the other thing is just clean up the government agencies so they talk to each other. You know, for example, the guy that did that shooting in the church down in Texas,
right?
You know, he was on a no gun list for the Air Force, but the Air Force never got that to the background
right.
folks, and he was able to pack a background check. So, you know, I think short term we have to do things. The other things I love.
Let me move on again here. I just remind our listeners they're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking with two candidates for the 13th State House District in the Parkville area. What about abortion, gentlemen? A recent court of appeals ruling in Missouri could result in the state having just one facility where the procedure is performed, and that would be over in St. Louis. Is that acceptable to you, or does the issue need to be addressed, Vic?
Well, again, you know, again, I'm an anti-abortion candidate. I've been endorsed by Right to Life, and you know, I would always push for adoption. We've had some experience that within my own family. You know, except in severe cases, and I do think that making sure that we fund Planned Parenthood and some of the other organizations so that we can prevent the pregnancy in the first place.
So you're funding Planned Parenthood.
Yeah. Well, not for abortion purposes, but for women's hygiene and reproductive rights. I do believe in that. Because I think prevention is a big thing. If you don't get pregnant in the first place, then we don't have to worry about abortion.
Mitch, I'm wondering where you come down on the whole abortion question and this lack of clinic. Now that appears to be in the offing in the state.
So I'm pro-life. I don't feel I grew up with sisters and a niece, and I could never tell them what they can do with their body. I am endorsed by Planned Parenthood. I think going down to one facility in the state is a mistake, because even, and I've had this conversation at the doors with people who are pro-life, if we do ban abortion, what happens is those who are well off can still get an abortion, but those who don't, I mean, you're risking people's lives. And when you have one facility in the state, if somebody has to drive across the state, there is a waiting period for them to get an abortion. Some of them live in their cars. Like, mm-hmm. these are people who are, you know, a lot of them are low income. They don't have a lot of money. It's definitely not a planned pregnancy. So I think limiting the facilities where they can go and get a safe abortion, I think that I would be against that.
Just a couple of other quick things in the few seconds we have left. Based on what you know, would you have voted for the impeachment of former Governor Eric Greitens? Vic, what would you have done?
Well, that's a really good question, because I don't have all the information, but based on the information that has come out publicly that, you know, we read in the newspaper, then I would probably have to say yes. And primarily not related to more of the moral issue, but related to the issue related to the Missouri Ethics Commission and his improper use of the mailing list.
Donor list, yeah.
Yeah, that turned out to be more egregious. And it wasn't so much the fact that he did use the mailing list, because I almost understand that. It would be almost like you build a business, in his case, a nonprofit, and you've spent years and years and you know, you've got that, you've gotten all those donors and you know them very personally, and then you turn around and use them for your campaign. I can see where that would be cloudy. However, it was the cover up after that, and he said, oh, I got permission, and then I didn't get permission. And then the other
this
guy
is using the donor list from the Mission Continues.
Yeah,
the nonprofit
yeah,
that he
and,
formed.
And the other thing is, we haven't really talked much about dark money, but I do think, you know, immediately forming, you know, his nonprofit and then not being able to disclose those donors. I mean, Mitch and I are both for transparency. We'd like to see those things closed.
Mitch, how about you? Governor Greitens, would you have favored his impeachment?
Yes. And you look at, like Vic was saying, it was lawmakers on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was something they were in agreement. And the cover-up sometimes is worse than the crime.
Okay, we're going to leave our conversation there. I want to thank the two candidates for the 13th State House District up in Parkville for coming in. Vic Allred, the Republican in the race. Mitch Weber is the Democrat. Thank you both. Keep running clean, guys. It's nice thank to have a civil conversation here between two candidates for the State House.
Well,
I appreciate
it. We've committed
it
to each other to do that.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
Okay, time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk with a veteran about the moral injury factor when it comes to war and what that is and what kind of damage it causes. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we discussed the Kansas City Zoo's proposal for a new aquarium. The zoo has received more than $60 million from donors, but will need support from the city to proceed. Hear more at kcur.org/uptodate. On Monday, Kansas governor candidate Greg Orman will be in studio to talk about his decision to run as an independent, and will ask about his proposals to improve the way Kansas is run. Join us Monday for Kansas independent candidate Greg Orman. Well, the psychological toll of military combat was underscored a year ago by the Department of Veterans Affairs, which found suicide rates more than 20% higher for America's veterans than non-veterans. The Kansas City Public Library is starting a veterans writing workshop designed to address those invisible wounds of war by offering a creative outlet for sharing thoughts and experiences or for exploring original ideas. The first of five weekly sessions at the library's Plaza Branch launches Saturday morning with a public presentation featuring an Iraq War veteran and noted author, and that's poet Brian Turner. Brian Turner is with us here this morning. He's an Iraq veteran and Guggenheim Fellowship recipient for poetry. He's the author of Hear Bullet, which chronicles his time in Iraq. And Brian, so good to have you. Welcome to Kansas City. And
oh, it's an honor to be on the show. Thank you so much.
Well, these invisible wounds that you're talking about here are today known as moral injuries. You spent 7 years as an infantryman in Iraq and in Bosnia as well. How would you describe the moral injuries you suffered over there?
I think if I speak maybe more broadly, it might help in some sense.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a lifelong process trying to sort of come to terms with the things that are part of serving in a combat zone, for example. So, you know, a firefighter or a police officer, oftentimes, if say a firefighter, for example, they will go into the fire and they do these brave, amazing things, men and women who take on that task. And I don't know how they do it. I'm amazed by them every time I see it.
Right.
But at the same time, a soldier sometimes will decide to go into a city and they will, some part of the oath sometimes is to start the fire, in a sense, and to begin the trouble. In response to political events or whatever it might be. But
conflicts with moral values, that can create some issues, right?
Right. And oftentimes there are those who are injured who have nothing. Most of the people on a battlefield, like in a country, are not involved in the fighting. So there's civilians on the battlefield, for example, and there can be innocents who are injured. And it's hard to come to terms with being involved in that process.
So how have you dealt with that? I mean, that's some pretty heavy stuff. What have you done to deal with it?
I think some of it is coming back home, and I've been helped by others in the process, just being welcomed back and having friendships and getting new experiences that aren't connected necessarily to that. So it's one is finding a way into the rest of my life is mm-hmm. one thing. But I still have, you know, we carry history inside of us. And so that history, you know, there are times where it's 3 a.m. and I have to figure out how to live with myself and the things that are, you know, inside of me and the things I've been a part of. I think for me, writing is very helpful. I don't usually use the word therapeutic necessarily, but I think there's something about taking memory, but then finding words to sort of encapsulate and put a form to that memory.
How tough was it for you to go from infantryman to writer? I mean, how did you get started?
Well, I had an unusual course because writing's the through line of my life. So I already got an MFA, a master's degree in creative writing and poetry before I joined the Army.
So you had the Jones before you went off to war.
So I think if I'd been 19 and gone without that, I wouldn't have had the tools that I did have. So I was helped by that process already, even through my experience.
What's so helpful about writing for a soldier, a former soldier? What is it that brings you some comfort?
For me, it's in the sharing. Because I didn't realize at the time, I wrote my first book, Hear Bullet, that you mentioned. Those were poems written in my notebook when I was in Iraq. Mm. They were published when I came home. Mm-hmm. They didn't, when I wrote them, they didn't relieve the pressure or the problems that I was dealing with at the time. I could still be killed tomorrow, or I could still make a mistake and get someone to my left and right killed, you know?
Right.
But over the years, coming back home, reading them and sharing them with people, I think there's been a sort of cumulative healthy effect. And I think part of it is
sharing. Help me with that, because part of you, you're reliving the horror you had gone through when you do that kind of sharing, though, right?
You know, I'm not
It's counterintuitive a little bit.
It is. I think part of it is might be connected to the blues. And, you know, you have the blues, but singing them out can help you sort of sweat it out of your body a bit. But part of it is it's a communal thing, because war seems to be, for us mostly in our modern American experience, done overseas in some ways. And so it's remote, it's distant, a small part of the population is involved. But it takes a nation to go to war. And so coming back, here when I'm in Kansas City, I'll be working a lot with veterans. But oftentimes I'm not working with veterans. And I find great value in that as well, because the larger community needs to, we need to all be in conversation about what we're a part of.
I'm wondering how you work. I mentioned in the opening you're going to be doing this workshop Saturday morning, tomorrow morning at the Kansas City Library on the Plaza. Mm-hmm. This is the first of a series of workshops, you know, aimed at helping veterans begin to write as a way of coping with what they've been through. You know, for someone who didn't have the writing experience that you did, and they show up tomorrow morning, how do you get them sort of moving in the direction of writing either a poem or a story? Because I've read that you get them writing right away.
Well, I hope so. I'll get them a pen if they don't have one, and some paper. We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things I'm excited about, and this doesn't happen with all of them, of course, but some of my favorite military authors came out of the Vietnam War. So Bruce Weigel and Yusuf Komunyakaa, those, when they came, they hadn't studied writing so much prior to that, especially like Bruce Weigel. But it took many years for those books to start appearing from him. And now we have this legacy of this great work that he's done. And that'll happen for some of the veterans that we encounter in our current, you know, sort of wave of veterans. But for me, mostly getting them writing is I try to keep it simple in some ways, because, you know, the craft, sometimes we hear the word poetry and we think it's this vaulted language that's up on a pedestal. And, and really, it's just an age old, it's deep in our DNA. It goes from campfires back when we were in Mesopotamia, even, you know, back in the Gilgamesh, where I was in Iraq. Gilgamesh, that old epic poem comes, those words come from that landscape.
Right.
And so the idea is really to see that poetry is a rhymed way of telling stories, in a sense, oftentimes. Mm-hmm. It's not always that, but it can be. And I want to hear and hopefully encourage the writers around the table to start sharing some of their stories on the page.
Is that what you do at these workshops, like tomorrow morning? Will you actually go around the room and have people share some of their memories, some of their stories, and then see if that begins to translate to something on the page?
If I had more time consecutively, so I'll only be here tomorrow. This is a series of writing events, but if I were with them for 6 months or a year, then I would do that. But I want to create a sense of... I don't want to put them on the spot, in a sense. So I'd like them to be able to... they can write for themselves in their notebook. And if I'll give them opportunities, if they do want to share it, then they can. But I don't want that person who's writing something very raw and very, maybe it's the first time they've ever put it to words. I don't want to force them to feel like they have to share that at that point. I think it's enough if they're able to find a way to start articulating the things that are inside them that are difficult to deal with.
And for a lot of people, you're saying this stuff, this act of writing really helps.
I believe it does. I think sometimes they're surprised by what it is about memory, because oftentimes we have the silent soliloquy that's in our head, that's our voice in our head when we think about it, our lives. But when we start to articulate it out loud or put it on the page, it comes out differently, and then we can see it from a distance. And that distance can give us some perspective on our life.
That's really interesting. I want to read back to you something you once said, because I really liked it a lot. You said this: writing gives them the chance to experience those feelings which can seem overwhelming, but writing somehow keeps that under control. Sometimes when you open with speaking, people can get too deeply emotionally wrought, and then they feel overly exposed. So I guess the moral of the tale is writing can be a quieter, safer entry to exploring some of these feelings? Is that what you're driving at there?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. That's
And
also because they don't necessarily have to share it with anyone else, because there are no books. Like, I've become a writer in a public sense, but there are things I write for myself and things I write to share in a public sense. And I'll let them know that tomorrow too, that it's okay to have your notebooks and to write about things that maybe you never show anybody else in the rest of the world.
Right.
But the act of figuring out a way to articulate the experiences you've had, there is a healthy effect that's done just in that process alone. And then for me, I found once I share it in a larger group setting, there's another added benefit. But then I wouldn't want to force that on anyone.
Writer and poet Brian Turner is my guest. He's offering a workshop tomorrow morning at the Kansas City Public Library on the plaza. It begins at 10:15 Saturday morning. More information for this event and how to RSVP, you can find it at kclibrary.org. You know, Brian, you have such a great reputation. I wonder if you could read us one of your poems. And I was thinking of one. It's titled Eulogy.
Sure. I'd be honored. Eulogy. It happens on a Monday at 11:20 a.m. as tower guards eat sandwiches and seagulls drift by on the Tigris River. Prisoners tilt their heads to the west, though burlap sacks and duct tape blind them. The sound reverberates down concertina coils the way piano wire thrums when given slack, and it happens like this on a blue day of sun when Private Miller pulls the trigger to take brass and fire into his mouth. The sound lifts the birds up off the water. A mongoose pauses under the orange trees, and nothing can stop it now, no matter what blur of motion surrounds him, no matter what voices crackle over the radio in static confusion, because if only for this moment the earth is stilled, and Private Miller has found what low hush there is, down in the eucalyptus shade, there by the river.
Did that one come from some personal experience you had?
Yeah, in Iraq, Private Miller committed suicide while we were there.
His name was Private Miller.
Yeah, and I wanted to read that one today. I'm grateful for you giving me the opportunity, because part of the process of hopefully writing about this is maybe we find one person who is just on the edge, and maybe this opportunity to be in part one of these writing classes during this period might be a journey away from that, the direction they might have gone in. So those men and women who we might be able to help them find their way into the rest of their life rather than choosing this route. You know, Miller, he killed himself in Mosul, northern Iraq, and that poem was very important to me. When we came back from Iraq, the colonel gave a speech, and at one point he listed the names of those who did not come back with us, and he didn't say the name of Private Miller. And it felt like he'd been erased, because I don't know what the colonel was thinking, but maybe like it wasn't a warrior's death, you know, or something. I don't know. But so it's been a very, very strong mission for me to make sure that we recognize this person's service.
And remember him.
And the loss.
Yeah. Was he a friend of yours?
Well, he was a comrade in the platoon. You know, I do remember that week, he'd been, their vehicle was down or something, wasn't working. So we'd cross-loaded that squad with the rest of the platoon. And I remember Miller was sitting inside the vehicle. We had these Stryker vehicles, a 19-ton armored vehicle with the squad inside of it and hatches where a couple of people are standing up at looking out. And Miller was up against the radio, sitting down, sleeping up against the radio, which was the best sleeping spot in the vehicle, you know. And I was at the other end near the hatch or near the ramp, and his squad leader was across from me. It was a very quiet moment, but I remember saying to Zizi, his squad leader, who's from Wisconsin, I remember saying, Miller, he's a good guy, isn't he? And it was just, and Zizi just kind of looked at me and he shook his head and said, yeah, he's a good guy. And then the other thing I'd say is Miller had very thick glasses, these army issued glasses, which, right. And I remember asking him once, I said, hey, Miller, when are we going home? And he was like kind of confused. I said, I know you can see the future with those glasses. When are we going home?
They're so strong.
Yeah.
You can see everything.
Yeah.
But you don't know why he did what he did.
I have some ideas. Some stories are not for me to tell, I feel. Some stories I have right to tell, and some I'm not sure if I have the right to tell. So I try to make sure I'm careful about that.
You know, we hear so much about the suicide issue among veterans, you know, once they've come back home. You're describing one that happened overseas. Mm. How does it factor into soldiers' lives, you know, in combat situations? What did you see over there?
Yeah, he was the only suicide I know of there. I was in Bosnia before that, and There was one there, if I remember right, but I didn't know that person. So I wasn't very close to that loss. But, you know, there's this cumulative sense of loss that's hard to recognize. You can Google very quickly and see not only the names of all those who've died in Iraq and Afghanistan among American service members, but you can see their faces and with the photos that they have for them and all. But since they've come home, these different rotations over the years, the suicide rate, there's some argument about it, but some say somewhere between 18 to 22 per day, and I believe that's the Iraq and Afghan service members, those who've served in those war zones and when they've come back.
That's a lot.
Right?
That's a lot of pain.
I arrive here today, say there's 18, tomorrow's 18, I go back home late tomorrow night, by the next day, my platoon is gone. Mm-hmm. And it's just this quiet loss all throughout the country that's felt by individual families and communities. But the aggregate is not really, I think, really fully appreciated.
I was going to say, we don't hear all that much about this, do we?
No. There have been some stories over the years, but I think it really has to be when there's a call for a potential future war, like this has to be a much bigger part of the conversation, because we have to think about the lifespan of a war is much longer than what historians give to it. When you go to a graveyard and you look at the death date of a person, it usually shows when they're born and when they died. You open a history book and you can look up any war that's been recorded, and then it'll say when it was started and when it ended.
Right.
But they're all wrong. The wars outlive the dates the historians give them, you know?
That's really interesting. You know, I'm wondering about your own background and why you went to war to begin with. In reading about you, you come from a long line of military men in your family. Did you feel you had any choice but to enlist, or was it more complicated than that?
It was more complicated, and there were a few women too, but mostly men, going back to the American Civil War, as far as I know. I don't know further back than that, but... Now, I think they were surprised because I almost joined the Marines twice when I was 19. The recruiters, when I took the tests, they, I don't know if they were telling me the truth or not, but they said it was that I'd maxed out the test. And I remember thinking, on a good day, if I was lucky, my verbal acuity, maybe. You know, maybe I did well in the test. But I knew my mechanical aptitude, not a chance.
Not a chance.
So they must be pulling my leg or something. And so I just paused on it, and I was in a band at the time, and I thought, oh, I'm going to finish college. There was an and then at some point I realized that I remember thinking, I'm going to miss it, because I was older. I was almost to the cutoff of when they would allow people to join. So I joined the Army. And I think
How old were you?
I think it was about 30 at the time.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's pretty unusual, isn't it?
Yeah. In the late 90s, that was 98 to 99. It was right at the cusp of the beginning of 99. So that's why I went to Bosnia from 99 to 2000,
mm-hmm.
right? But at that period, what I recognized is there's usually one or two guys like me in any platoon, in an infantry platoon, that would have a degree in, you know, history or sociology or something, and seemed to be sprinkled throughout the company. But then as the 2000, 9/11 hit, and then after when the economic downturn especially, there were a couple different waves of people who joined, and I saw a lot more people like myself. It was more common that you'd see older folks.
Why did you want to do it in the late 1990s? I mean, what was it that drove you? Because there's a reason we send young men to war.
Sure.
And there is a reason that they're not 30 years old.
Yeah, absolutely. I think part of it was, I mentioned this as a memoir I wrote, and I'll just paraphrase one of the sections in there, is that I think deep down in a psychological level, and it took me a while to figure this out. I came back, and it's part of the reason I wrote the memoir. In writing the memoir, this gets right back to the workshops we're doing. Like, I kind of figured out by writing it out, I had to write myself into the thought, which was, in order to understand those who I most revered, like my grandfather and my father and some of my uncles, that there would always be these distant islands and explosions and things that I had no concept of and I had no real appreciation for.
Right.
And so for me...
So you wanted to connect with them in a sense.
I think in a deep level, something I was learning when I was 7 was like the construction of manhood and what it meant to be a man is sometimes you have to... In American culture, oftentimes the warrior class usually goes off to a distant place, it's the old hero's narrative, goes through a test of fire and then comes back changed if they survive and oftentimes doesn't speak about it except to those who are in that sort of group, right? So for example, even when I joined the Army, there wasn't much conversation. Well, I wasn't home as much too, but right before I went to Iraq, that was the first time really my grandfather talked to me about actual war. Before that, all through childhood, it was always the periphery of war. I got the long, how big the ocean was and what that island looked like, but not the things that kept them up at late at night. I got none of that until
he opened up to you at that point.
Yeah, and especially once I came back from a war, then some of the veterans in the family opened up about those things more.
What did you learn about them in the course of all that?
Well, part of that, I revere them as, you know, definitely, but part of what I came to discover in a sense is there's a way of looking at and seeing that it's a kind of pathology. Because in order to become like the people that I revere, I have to go through this test of fire and come back, and, you know, and basically I'm repeating a thing rather than trying to improve upon it necessarily. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah,
I don't mean, you know, there'll be people out there maybe listening to this. I hope they won't misunderstand me. I don't mean to apply this to other families. I'm saying, and I think I should have had different reasons for, you know, maybe better reasons for joining.
Right.
But there were others that were much more beneficial. Like I used to be very shy, right? And you can't be shy in the military. You have to get an outside voice. You got to talk. So I never would have taught classes and things like that.
Right.
I was in a band, but I was the bass player, so you just hang out with the drummer. So we would do things in public. I wasn't that shy, but I wasn't going to get up to the microphone and talk to anybody. You know. So the military helped me find my way into my life and to be a stronger individual as well.
You know, before you go, could you read one more for us?
Sure.
You have one there, R&R.
Yes. R&R. The curve of her hip where I'd lay my head. That's what I'm thinking of now. Her fingers gone slow through my hair on a blue day 10,000 miles off in the future somewhere, where the beer is so cold it sweats in your hand, cool as her kissing you with crushed ice, her tongue wet with blackberry and melon. That's what I'm thinking of now, because I'm all out of adrenaline, all out of smoking incendiaries. Somewhere deep in the landscape of the brain, under the skull's blue curving dome, that's where I am now, swaying in a hammock by the water's edge, as soldiers laugh and play volleyball just down the beach, while others tan and talk with the nurses who bring pills to help them sleep. And if this is crazy, then let this be my sanatorium. Let the doctors walk among us here, marking their charts as they will. I have a lover with hair that falls like autumn leaves on my skin, water that rolls in smooth and cool as anesthesia, birds that carry all my bullets into the barrel of the sun.
Birds that carry all my bullets into the barrel of the sun. That's called a nice line, Brian. That's a spectacular line.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I was surprised by that when I wrote it, and I'm almost always surprised by it when I read it. And one of the mantras that I keep as a writer and maybe as a human being is a quote from Twain, which is no surprise. No surprise in the writer. No surprise in the reader, no tears in the writer, no tears in the reader. Yeah.
Well, I got riggers hearing you read that line here in person. Again, Brian Turner will be at the Kansas City Public Library 10:15 tomorrow morning to conduct the first of a series of workshops, veterans writing workshops there at the library. You can RSVP kclibrary.org. What a pleasure to have you here. Thanks so much for taking some time.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Brian Turner. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Coy Duggar, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Emily Reed. This KCUR programming note, starting this Sunday at 3 through to the midterm elections, will air NPR's The Politics Show. Get a deep dive into the elections across the country every Sunday at 3. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.